everyone to this afternoon's session, Connections Between Methods and Results in Different Approaches. Our first speaker will be Tim Kozlowski from the University of New Brunswick.
Right. Thank you to the organizers for inviting me to talk about this. I want to talk about asymptotic safety in a pure matrix model, and the particular matrix model that I will present where we did actual calculations is what you, or many of you know as the matrix model for 2D quantum gravity, which is a well-known, well-studied model in various approaches, and the approach that Astrid and I have been taking, the taking to that is from the function, is using the functional renormalization group to reproduce some of the results that have been produced there. And the idea behind all, behind this is that these matrix, these two-dimensional matrix models for quantum gravity, they are actually, they are on the one hand the blueprint for, Raswan has mentioned that in his talk yesterday, they are in a way a blueprint for higher dimensional tensor track models, models that go under the name TensorTrack now. So if you want to implement, or if you want to use the functional renormalization group methods in the TensorTrack or in group field theories, then the first thing to learn how the techniques can be used and what you can actually produce, reproduce with those techniques, with functional renormalization group techniques, it's the first obvious model to look at. And so this is work that I've done with Astrid. And as an intermediate step, I will just briefly mention a little bit of work that I've done with Alessandro Sontrini a couple of years ago on that. So this talk is in, the session is called Connections Between Methods and Results from Different Approaches to, I suppose, approaches to quantum gravity. So that's, oops, that's the treasure chest that is here. And here's a map where I just randomly put approaches that I think most people in the audience will be covered. If
excuse me, so the fact you put strings next to the skull.
so there would be. So, so we can dwell on this map for half an hour and not come to the talk. So the question is, we believe that there is a quantum theory of gravity, but we haven't found it on this map. And most, I think, perimeter is a very nice place because perimeter is a place where people from very different approaches come together. And it's the ideal place for a conference like this because you can really interchange, you can really talk to each other. And the reason these interactions are, why I find them necessary, is because if you just take a step back and ask why do we not have a theory of quantum gravity? Well, there could be two fundamental answers. One is more fatalistic, is it's just not attainable. There is no quantum gravity. It could, for example, be that we should think about classical gravity and we have to explain why we see quantum theory at low energies. Or some other crazy idea is really realized in nature, and this thing just doesn't exist, and that's why we haven't found anything. The other idea, which is of course the working assumption of most people here, is that it's just a very subtle question, and that by now we have a long list of criteria that we want to impose on a theory of quantum gravity. And there are just so many things that you have to take care of before you can call your pet theory a theory of quantum gravity, that it is really a game of piecing, of finding many, many pieces that have to all fit together to one big picture. And that, of course, leads to the theme of this afternoon, is you want to combine approaches because each approach has some built-in features. For example, and they have some built-in features, but they also have some things that are really hard to solve in a problem. And my personal example goes back when I was about finishing my PhD. I had been working on loop quantum gravity with a background, which was mentioned by Daniele and Bianca at that time. And my idea was the hard problem in loop quantum gravity is to get a phase diagram. I wanted that background geometries emerge dynamically from loop quantum gravity. And I had the idea that this should happen in a similar way in which a Bose condensate forms in usual, say, scalar, but just a free scalar field theory. That didn't work out for many technical reasons. I spent a lot of time trying to generalize that, and it didn't work. And so I looked around, and it was very fortunate at the time there was a paper by Martin Reuter, and I think Holger Weyer was the co-author on conformally reduced gravity, and it had a very long title, and it contained and a spontaneously broken phase of gravity. So there was a renormalization group approach in which you get a vacuum expectation value for the gravitational field. That was my understanding at the time. So I thought, well, that could be a way out. But before I could apply that to loop quantum gravity, because there is no simple way to combine the two, I had to make several simplifying assumptions. For one, what also Razvan has been mentioning and Daniele, I went to think about group field theories as a proto-theory to loop quantum gravity, or as probably the formulation of the dynamics of loop quantum gravity. And then, of course, if you're doing group field theory, then it's not a long step to go to matrix models, because group field theories for two-dimensional quantum gravity are essentially matrix models, and they are well-studied problems there. So this is the topic of the talk. I want to find the phase diagram. This was the original motivating question that came out from a completely different approach for tensor models for quantum gravity, and it seems that the functional renormalization group equation is a useful tool to systematically study these phases, because you can do straightforward calculations, and whatever result you get, you see a vacuum structure. Then you see an effective action, and you see and you can guess what the universality classes are, even if it's just an approximation. And so I won't talk too much about that because this was in much better explained by Razvan in his talk. So the particular matrix model that I will consider here is a Hermitian matrix model where I have a usual matrix propagator, so the double line indicates contractions of indices, and this 5-4 interaction indicates which indices. So here's a 5-5-5-5, and which indices of the phi's are contracted. So that's a trace of phi to the 4 interaction. And then, as also Razvan explained, there is a topological expansion for these models, and you can identify these models in a large n limit with, you can relate the partition function to a partition function of a quantum gravity model. It's not the same, I will show that in a couple of slides, but there is a relation between the two, and I think Björn will talk about that. I don't know. Maybe a little bit. So there is one intermediate step that I will make really short, and this is mentioning work that I've done with Alessandro Spontrini, which was mainly Alessandro's master's thesis. And that is, if you start with a pure matrix model, you have unitary symmetry. So all matrix entries, all degrees of freedom are the same, and they are protected by a symmetry to be the same. So you don't have, a priori, an infrared suppression scale. You have to introduce that by hand. However, there is, from non-commutative geometry, there are well-known models, in particular two dimensions, what we did was a four-dimensional model that had just been studied also by Vincent's group, and Raswan was heavily involved in that. It has been shown to be asymptotically safe using a very particular mechanism. And the idea and the nice thing about that model is, on the one hand, it is motivated as a non-commutative geometry, so we have position space and we can really take a lot of intuition from continuum physics, from standard quantum field theory, into that model. And it in particular tells us that, so the gist of that is matrix size, it also has a matrix representation. So the same model can, on the one hand, be represented as a non-commutative field theory on R4, or as a matrix model, or better, it's really a tensor model, but with a trivial tensor structure. And there you really identify that the matrix size cutoff is really the cutoff, the physical cutoff that you would put on a physical Laplacian in that model. And that was the thing, that was the main thing that we learned from that, apart from techniques, calculational techniques for matrix models, are looking at that. And I will just go over that really quickly, and then, because this model, because it has been shown to be asymptotically safe, that's a benchmark result that you would like to reproduce with the functional renormalization group. And so it is really a testing ground, this model. So this is a short motivation, and then I want to go to the real deals, which is the two-dimensional quantum gravity matrix model, which goes under, there is a particular non-Gaussian fixed point that goes under the name double scaling limit because of a different way of thinking about this, not in terms of the renormalization group as I represented, but in terms of a statistical state sum model. And the aim of this program or of this work is to use the double scaling limit as a benchmark result that you want to reproduce in some approximation with the functional renormalization group equation. And see if that goes. So in a way, if I talk to one half of this room, the half that comes from functional renormalization group equation, you would see this, I use your tool, and I want to see whether I can, whether it's a good tool in a setting that is partially new. If you come from the combinatorial side, from what Raswan and Daniele have and Bianca also have been introducing yesterday, then it's really I want to show you that there is a tool that is possibly very helpful. And I heard Vinsaw this morning over coffee saying that it could probably be helpful to have approximate tools to get an idea of what the faces are in tensor models. And then when you have an idea, then you know what to look for with your analytic constructive field theory tools. And so that is those are the two ways to address this. So I already described that the Grosse-Wolkenhorn model is, on the one hand, it's a scalar 5-4 theory that has an interesting extra part to the kinetic term, which makes it actually, which is actually the reason why it becomes asymptotically safe. And the interesting thing here is what was important for us was that the model can, on the one hand, be written as a field theory in direct space on R4. And on the other hand, the same theory, I have taken this extra coupling constant, omega, here to 1. And then the theory has an internal inversion symmetry. And this is, when you think about the Moyal plane, it's really, there are x's and p's in the Moyal plane. And this is really an inversion symmetry basically between x's and p's. Basically what the Fourier transform does between x's and p's on the Moyal plane. And so that's all I want to say about that. But Laurent this morning has been mentioning.
That's exactly what
you're all. Yeah, yes, this was precisely what Laurent has been talking about. So we used that, and there were at the time 6 years ago quite recent results about asymptotic safety for finite but small values of lambda in this model. So the renormalization group flow was bounded if lambda was small enough. There was a global bound on the RG flow of lambda. And moreover, this self-dual point, this omega equals 1, which makes the inversion between x's and p possible, that turned out to be UV attractive, which is what I wrote here. And these were the two features that we wanted to find with the functional renormalization group. And essentially, what it helped us was really see that all the ingredients, all the things that you learn from a review on the functional renormalization group equation, if you translate them into the matrix space, starting from direct space here and using this kinetic term to construct your cutoff, then everything goes through and you get the same structure of the functional renormalization group equation. You get the same type of, you can use the same type of cutoff. It's sensible. You have a theory space which is essentially this is actually, these traces here are actually replacements of integrals over direct space, and these are Laplacian. Essentially, these XX are Laplace operators. So you get something that looks very much like like a gradient expansion, plus something that occurs very naturally here are these multi-trace operators, which would be multiple integrals or nested integrals that you don't usually use in a field theory. However, here they turn out, and that will also be important in the matrix model, they turn out to be important. They do contribute to the running. In the Grosse-Wolkenhorn model, if you take theta to infinity, if you take I keep the dimension of theta and I take k to infinity at the end, then they turn out to be suppressed, and actually you can show that there is an exponential bound on their suppression. So which is
this is
then deep in the UV. Yes. So they're really irrelevant as you expect them to be irrelevant. And this is Dalian Litim's talk this morning. This model really realizes the hypothesis that you have. There is a power counting marginal coupling constant here, this lambda. And even at finite values of lambda, the hypothesis is correct that that all irrelevant couplings are essentially suppressed by the canonical mass dimension. That's what turns out to happen. Although it would not have to happen because you have an interacting field theory at that point. Okay, so I need to hurry up. And the summary of this part of the talk is we can reproduce the results of the Grosse-Wolkenhausen model. And with that, along several years ago, I started working with Astrid. First, it was Astrid's calculations alone, and then I joined her in that. And we looked at what many of you will know as the two-dimensional gravity model, which is that using the logic that was presented by Renate Loll in her talk yesterday, and probably will be repeated by Jan Ambjorn today, that the gravity partition function is related to the partition function of a matrix model by this relation, and that quantum gravity turns out to be the two-dimensional quantum gravity turns out to be a critical theory in the limit where the matrix size becomes large, where the matrix size goes to infinity, and where these coupling constants are fine-tuned to a critical coupling constant in such a way that the dimensional suppression of the topological expansion is just canceled, just barely canceled by that. But that is really from the point of view of the renormalization group, that's just a fixed point of the renormalization group if you look at running in N. And that is the way we can do that, we can look at that in using the functional renormalization group equation. So what we did was we actually didn't use the phi to the 3 model. We used the phi to the 4 model, which has also been studied in the literature extensively, which is just not that it's implementing at the fundamental level triangulations, but triangulations or tessellations by squares. This has, for the renormalization group, this has an advantage because the additional set 2 symmetry prevents certain operators that are disturbing from appearing in the flow equations, and then the flow equation closes and you don't run into problems. And what is nice about this is there are analytic results about the relevant critical exponents also for that. And Beresin and Saint-Justin and Alia have done perturbative calculations that can be used to compare our functional renormalization group equation results with that. This is Hermitian matrices. A similar matrix model that is actually, I think, closer to the tensor track than this one is to take a real matrix model but have a symmetry under 2 orthogonal transformations, because that tells you that only phi transpose phi can appear in traces, and it can only appear as this combination rho. And that looks already very, very reminiscent of this type of colored. Determined actually, we did also some calculations in this model in our paper. But there are no benchmark results to compare to. That's why I focus on the pure, on the uncolored matrix model. And so in this, one remark to that. The geometric intuition tells you that both ways of formulating should lead to a tessellation by squares, and indeed, you find in some miraculous way that is really hard to show analytically how the transformation goes, but in the n to infinity limit, the leading order in the 1 over n expansion of these two models coincide. The subleading orders do not coincide. So if you look at what comes at the order 1 in the 1 over n expansion, that in the beta functions, they are exactly the same, but then you get some things that are just different between these models. But so in the large n limit, they are, of course, then the same beta functions, and they lead to the same continuum limit. 5 minutes. Okay. So we did that, and then what I have to tell you for doing functional renormalization, I have to tell you what theory space I use. So I consider this as a field theory of a matrix. So this phi here is a matrix. I have an effective action as a function of phi. And I explained before that only this row, only this phi transpose phi, or the phi or a phi squared appears in the renormalization group equation. So I have invariants that are trace phi squared, trace phi force, and so on. And I have an arbitrary function of that. So that defines my theory space. I already explained there is no natural Laplacian, so I have to introduce something by hand. That does break the unitary or bi-orthogonal symmetry that the model has. And in a minute, when I show you our results, you will see that there is a tendency to mismatch the analytic results for these models. And my guess is that it is because in our calculations, we have broken the symmetry and we have not restored it at the order in which we expand the function, the right-hand side of the functional renormalization group equation. So we have just broken it and left it at that, which is similar to what has been done in many works to the what was mentioned in Tim Morris's talk on Monday, when you do the gravity functional renormalization group equation, you just leave the background field and do not consider what is usually written as gamma hat, the running of that, and use the splitting word identity to constrain the symmetry. I think that our tendency to mismatch results is due to that, to not doing that. So we do that. Then one thing that comes out, if you just look at the structure of equations that you get from the functional renormalization group equation, if you want that the beta functions at the end admit a 1 over n expansion, then you're not uniquely specifying a mass dimension or an n dimension for your coupling constants, but it gives you bounds that are quite stringent because the combinatorics of the beta functions tells you how the g's have to appear. And if you have something that goes wrong here, then this will just, then you will have a beta function that blows up when n becomes large and not becomes has a constant part plus stuff that goes with 1 over n. So that's a nice way of seeing the large n limit. So I should wrap up. And there are some techniques that we found useful in calculating that. We did the simplest approximation is taking a single trace truncation, so just take single trace operators. And for those, you can find a closed expression for the beta functions. And then you can do a fixed point analysis, and you find a fixed point that when you increase the truncation, the single trace truncation, you include more and more operators, more and more single trace operators, you find there is a fixed point candidate that is there, that where the relevant critical exponent is slightly above one, and it approaches one when you include more and more operators. And all other operators have negative dimension, and they go close to negative integers. So that is so. And also, when you look at the Hessian, the eigenoperators are very reasonably aligned with the trace phi to the 4 and then the other trace invariants. So they're close to them. So it's okay. So I have to wrap up. So I will just give you the summary, or I let you ask questions about the summary. The summary in one sentence, since I'm out of time, is that you can use the functional normalization group equation. You get answers. You find that difficulties are things like the role of the word identities that you know you should take into account in the functional normalization group approach are important or appear to be important. And on the other hand, so that's from for this side of the of the audience, and for the other side of the audience, there is a straightforward tool and calculational techniques to investigate matrix models and also tensor models. I mean, the calculational techniques that we used can be used for tensor models. It's just that they're combinatorics. It's much more complicated. That's why we didn't do it yet. But so I guess I stop here. Yes, sir.
I missed completely your point, it seems to me. So maybe you can go back. Which is that, as you say, in matrix model, there's no kinetic term, there's no Laplace.
That's right.
So you have to.
So you have.
There's no notion of normalization group.
That's.
So you have to cook up.
Yes, so you have to. So what you have to do is you have to. And I found this very good the way Raswan explained it. You have to. I mean, for the renormalization group for pure matrix models without any background, you just have to invent a slicing. You just have to.
Which one do you take? That's
completely arbitrary.
So which one do you take here?
So what we took here was something that if you have a matrix that has an upper left block of size n, let's call this little n, then our Laplacian gave that the number n. So if I have a matrix element MAB, what you can do is you can just say, if this is MAB, then say this is A plus B. You can do, there is some freedom in what you choose. It just has to grow as you go down in columns and rows.
Okay, what this model is different from matrix model then? We have another.
So this is what probably got lost because I was rushing through the talk. Where did I say that? So in this model, I have to invent a Laplacian, something like that. Just some way of layering the degrees of freedom, just saying what is low energy and what is high energy. And the only sensible way, as Raswan was saying, in an infinite large matrix model is to make this matrix size. In any finite dimension matrix model, you have an arbitrary choice of what you do. But in an infinitely large matrix model, there is no other way to make things small than making matrices. It's finite. But that necessarily breaks the unitary symmetry of that model, that if you have invariants that are traced phi squared, then you have this is invariant under u star phi.
So there's no more any reason to be.
So there is no more. This is.
That the observable are traces of matrices.
So this symmetry is broken, and there is. And the breaking is actually controlled by a broken word identity that I've written here. I didn't talk about it. I mentioned it in words. And we have so far in the approximation that we have worked with so far, we have ignored this breaking of the symmetry. What we should really do is we should include all these extra operators that contain functions of this Laplacian, functions of matrix elements A and B, so of the column and rows, and should keep them in our equation, and then restrict ourselves to the solution in the particular truncation that we use, to the approximate solution of this word identity. That's what we should really do, morally speaking.
But then you don't claim that this analysis has anything to do with the matrix model analysis.
Well, it has to do with it is an analog of doing functional renormalization in the background field method. There you have what Timoris has been talking about yesterday. There is a split a word identity that is. That goes with the split between background and fluctuation field. And if we work in a truncation in which you just retain background operators, background field operators, then that also breaks the split symmetry. And you have to, the quality of approximation is just that. And
so do you recover the usual exponents?
So that's what I, yeah, so we get, so in a single trace approximation, we find a fixed point, and we find, so usually the relevant critical exponent is, the analytic value is 4/5. And we find that it is about 1 when you make the single trace truncation very large to include a lot of. It approaches 1 from the above in this. So, and all the others are irrelevant, and you see that the bare action, so the eigenoperators that you have, they're reasonably aligned with the four-point interaction. And all the others are reasonably aligned with all the other eigenoperators are very close to the trace of phi to the 2n's. So it looks very similar to this limit. Yes.
So let me just check real quick.
I had exactly the same question as Laurent about the regulators.
Okay. Okay.
So we find the kind of critical value of g4 over.
So, I mean, we didn't, the point is that G4 turned out to be scheme dependent.
Yeah,
in what
but approximately what we find for G4, it's positive and negative, and that's positive and negative.
So it's kind of so similar to the result that you would expect. It doesn't fall on the exact value, but it's in the same.
I mean,
it's negative.
I didn't write them down because they had much more scheme dependence. than the critical exponents. The critical exponents were much better behaved, and that's what you expect because their dimension is there.
But here's a good question: what sign does it have? Does it, is it positive or negative?
No, the G4 has a negative sign, but as you would expect.
So this is on the right side.
Yes, it's on the right side. It's the quantum gravity side. It's not the field theory side. Yes. So I mean that's one of the things where you need to use the renormalization group equation, because even if the path integral is ill-defined, you can extract beta functions because you have through the regulator you have a Gaussian there in the functional renormalization group equation, and you can find beta functions.
So I just have one remark, because I also have already passed it to Astrid, but I mean it escapes me a little bit why in the double scaling limit you should see a critical point at all. I mean, for a fixed topology, I agree. But basically, in the double scaling limit, this critical point disappears. It's not there. I mean, when you solve for the double scaling limit, I mean, this cut, you know, there is a cut in the eigenvalues of the matrix model in the large n expansion. So this large n expansion has a radius of convergence. That's exactly what we're discussing here. But once you have taken the double scaling limit, this has disappeared. So it's surprising for me that you can, since you are never putting in any expansion in 1 over n squared in topology, it's very surprising to me that you can find this point. Because if you just look at if you just look at measure principle, of course.
So I cannot tell you the geometric interpretation of what we're doing. What I can tell you is the renormalization group setup and with the idea that was actually I didn't know about that until Raswan or Dario, one of them, told me about that several years ago about that this has actually been suggested by Beresin and Sinchester. To look at that just as a statistical model in its own right, and consider renormalization group flow in N. So whether that has any geometric interpretation, what we're doing, is not clear to me. That's only after the fact when you. So that's something that you will naturally ask, but that is inherently not an answerable question in the framework that I'm using. I mean.
All right, I'm sorry, I have to interrupt now.
Yeah, but I have an elemental answer.
It's a brief comment.
I think a brief comment that we have to discuss that is that for the theory without and going to infinity, you need to expect to have a fixed point too. So I think we have to discuss why this could explain you so far.
There's lots of interest, and let's continue this discussion this afternoon.